Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Single Tracks Podcast. My name is Aaron, and today we're here with a very special guest, Eddie O'Day. So many mountain bikers aspire to spending a night or two out on the trail with nothing but the items they can carry on their bikes. But few of us can imagine bike packing for weeks at a time, let alone doing it at a race pace day and night. Eddie O'Day is a professional endurance mountain bike racer and holds course records in the Stagecoach 400, the Trans North Georgia, and the Hurricane 300 Ultra Endurance Mountain Bike races. This year, he completed the Tour Divide and raised nearly $20,000 for the Georgia State High School Racing League along the way. So thanks for joining us, Eddie.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that introduction.
Yeah, you're welcome. So tell us a little bit about your background. How'd you get started in riding and racing?
Wow, that goes back a little ways. I don't know, I got a bike in, I think, 97, just kind of doing things on my own for a while, and then eventually hooked up with the Swamp Club down in the Tampa area. And they introduced me to cross-country racing, which I was okay at. Didn't show any signs of greatness there, but I did notice that the longer the race went, the better I did. So I definitely shifted my focus that way.
So when did that happen? When did you realize that the endurance, the stuff was more your cup of tea?
I think I did my first cross-country race in 2000. So it was probably 2001, 2002 before I really had a chance to start exploring those longer races. One of which, first 12-hour race I did was down in Markham Park, which is probably on its way to being a disaster right now. But I just found myself in the lead after about 5 hours. I couldn't actually believe that myself. I ended up falling apart in the last hour, but I was totally hooked. It was just, I don't know, it was thrilling to be able to push myself and try to find some new limits.
Yeah, so you did, I think probably the first time I met you was either doing the Fool's Gold race, which you used to organize, mm-hmm. or maybe even the Burn 24. So you used to do quite a bit of 24-hour racing as well, right? 24-hour solo stuff?
Correct, yeah. The Burn 24-hour was my first solo 24-hour race. And then I took over race directing a year or two later. But since that one, I think I've done maybe around, I don't know, low 20s number of 24-hour races solo. So a lot of experience with those all over the country.
Ouch. I know you also, so my Faster Mustache team that I'm a part of here in Atlanta, we used to do a little 24-hour urban race, which I believe you won on more than one occasion, right?
I only won it once.
Okay.
Yeah, the second year, I got into a duel with a couple other guys, and they got the better of me. I had to work on my road tactics. But yeah, those were a lot of fun, a little bit scary, but a lot of fun.
Yeah, racing 24 hours through the streets of Atlanta. How many miles did you put in that one? Close to 400 or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, just shy of 400, like 385, something like that.
Woof.
Yeah, it was. And never leaving pretty much downtown Atlanta, so it was, that's a lot of miles in traffic.
Yeah. So when did you start making the transition from, you know, like the 24-hour racing, the 12-hour racing into kind of more of like these bike packing events? Is that just because 24-hour racing is kind of
dead.
Gone away,
dead. It was a culmination of things for sure. 24-hour racing kind of dying off, and the number of races available and the sponsorships available for that style of racing kind of going away, but also a little bit of boredom at the same time. You know, having done 20-some 24-hour races where you're doing multiple laps, anywhere from, you know, 20 to 30-some laps of the same thing, it gets a little tedious and a little boring. There's certainly, it's a different style of racing, obviously, and there's support where with the bike packing, that was just kind of starting up, at least here in the Southeast, actually just as the FM 24-hour race it ended. So it was a fairly easy transition to that. The Trans North Georgia route became available in 2000, I believe the beginning of 2010, and the event was in September of that year. So that was kind of my first foray into it. And I wouldn't say I was bike packing at that point, as I brought no sleeping gear at all for that one. Not that I didn't need it, but I didn't bring it. It took a little while to kind of make that transition, and it wasn't my main focus still for another couple of years.
So what are the unique skills that you possess that make you really successful at riding these long distances?
Coming from that 24-hour racing world and learning how to manage myself, you know, physically and emotionally, without sleep is definitely a really helpful tool. I think that was probably one of the biggest things to just becoming successful in 24-hour racing is just getting from, you know, about 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. when everything seems to fall apart and everything in your head says, stop this. This is madness and stupid. And yet put that away and be able to stay on the gas. There's a lot of times, particularly in those 24-hour races, but I also found in the, we'll say, shorter, kind of weekend-long ultra races, I can make really big gains, you know, in that four-hour period when most people want to sleep, and I can push through that.
So is that something, you know, is that's just something like you learned about yourself while racing, or do you think that's something like an innate skill that you possessed from the beginning?
It was definitely learned. I mean, kind of, I guess naturally, I'm somewhat of an insomniac anyways. So that's kind of helpful, but to be able to take, you know, someone who has a hard time falling asleep to, you know, staying up and racing all night, that was definitely a skill that got honed over the years and sometimes, you know, executed better than other times.
So it sounds like you're saying the mental part is more difficult than the physical. I mean, a lot of people, I think they just focus on the physical and think there's no way I could do that. How could I ride for that long, you know, that fast? But it, you know, is that even the hard part?
No, I think I got a pretty high pain tolerance at this point. So no, it's true. I think the mental part is much harder. It may be that first 24-hour race, it was a lot more physical, or even really that first 12-hour race is kind of dealing with all the pain and truly knowing that pain is temporary. And it only tends to get to a certain point while you're still conscious. So you can kind of rely on that it's not going to hurt more. It's just going to hurt longer. And it's a really kind of sick way to think about things, but it's kind of where I had to go. But then learning how to put away those doubts and just all those things that scream in your head to stop this. Because the next one you do, you know how much it hurt last time. So it doesn't even hurt yet, but mentally you're just like, why am I going to go down this path again? So just, I don't know, throwing myself against that wall over and over again, I learned how to just shut all that down.
So along the lines of the mental aspect of racing, do you get nervous on these long distance races?
Absolutely. You
have to manage your adrenaline at all?
A little bit, because you can definitely go too hard. And so pacing is important there and not letting that excitement, that adrenaline kind of take over you like you would be able to do in a shorter race. You know, a couple hour cross country race, you pretty much want to tap into all that adrenaline and just use it all up. But yeah, you do that at the beginning of an ultra race, it's not going to be pretty. So yeah, definitely try to manage that. And also where I think it'll be more of a tactical race, you know, kind of use that against my competitors, you know, try to push them just a little bit more than they want to be pushed. And, you know, use that to break them so that I can ride alone later.
Later, suckers.
Yeah. Do you get comfortable then, like at various points during the race, or are you constantly thinking about, you know, your position and your competitors and that kind of thing? I mean, it seems like if you are, that's got to be exhausting after a few days, right?
I do. So most of my experience isn't kind of a weekend long ultra races. So did Tour Divide, and that's a whole different beast where like Stagecoach, Transnorth Georgia, Hurricane are all, you know, I'd say, what's that, like 28 to 50 hours long.
So only like 1 or 2 days.
Yeah, exactly.
Straight of riding the whole time.
So if I could just not sleep most of the time, that's resulted in a good result. So yeah, I do think about the competition part of it. And it can be exhausting to stay that focused for that long. And that's definitely, you know, I rolled some of that skill over from 24-hour racing where it tends to be really tactical. Because it's fairly short, I'll put that in quotes, but short enough that it's still tactical, where when you start pushing out to 48 hours, it's slightly less tactical. There's a lot of other things to manage with nutrition and, you know, all the physical things that can happen, but there's still tactics to it. I've been in some fairly close races over some of those ultra races.
Let's talk a little more about pacing. So how do you determine your pace? Do you go into an event and you have a specific mile per hour goal, or are you looking to cover a certain distance each day? Or, you know, how do you assess that, and how do you make those determinations before the race?
I'd say I'm better at that now than I was when I first started doing, particularly with ultra races. But I usually have kind of an average mile per hour in my head of what I want to do ahead of time, and then also break that down into various checkpoints, whether it's actually checkpoints in the sense that the race director put those out there or I created them myself, it's usually resupply points. So I'll, you know, have an idea that it's going to take me, you know, 3 hours to get from, you know, A to B. And then I can base my nutrition, my pacing, because all those two play together, right? Your pace starts falling apart and all of a sudden your nutrition needs change. It took you 4 hours to do what you thought was 3 hours. You need more nutrition available for that and or water. So those two kind of play together. And I try to put in the research to be able to execute that, which is maybe why I keep going back to some of the same races, because it's, I've already done the homework on those. It's always a little bit harder with a new to me race. And certainly if it's just a brand new race altogether and nobody really knows what's out there, that poses its own issues.
Is that part of the fun for you?
Yeah, it is. I like doing the homework. When I have time to do all the research, I've got a real job these days where when I first started doing these, I had a little more free time to put into the whole research end of it. We'll say, you know, with instance of like Transnorth Georgia that I did three times. By the time I did the third one, I knew exactly where I was going to refill my water bottles, how many I'd refill, exactly what was going into those. And I never had to carry any an ounce more of water than I needed at any moment in that race. And I know that from the get-go, which was really gave me a lot of confidence. And knowing, one, that I could execute that, but just the plan was there. All I had to do is go out and ride it and not try it. I didn't have to make a lot of decisions in that one. All I had to do was just go ride it.
Nice. So is there any, you know, specific training you do for bike packing races that's different from shorter races? I mean, is there anything you really can do to prep for days on end in the saddle?
And from a purely training aspect, I do a lot of, it's just longer intervals, you know, doing 2 minute intervals isn't really the kind of efforts that you're ever really want to do in those kind of races. So it's more like doing a lot of 20 minute to 1 hour efforts. And just, I mean, if we want to get into, you know, power numbers and all that, it's really just pushing the FTP power up. Lots of sweet spot training over and over and over again. It's a little tedious, but it's effective.
Yeah. So what about your bike setup? Sure, you know, kind of depending on what race you're doing, that's going to vary a little bit, you know, how long it is and, you know, the gear that you take with you. But like, let's say, you know, let's take the Transnorth Georgia, for instance, like what's your bike setup? What are you taking with you?
The last time I did, well, all three times I did Transnorth Georgia, I was still racing with Topeak Ergon then. So I was on a 26 inch hardtail.
Say what?
Yeah, I know. I was a holdout. I've moved on to 27.5 now if we want to argue about wheel size. But anyways, yeah, carbon hardtail. Try to make my bike and my kit as light as possible. So no sleep gear on that one. You know, like a Mylar emergency bivy just in case. And pretty much all I'm carrying is some repair items, you know, brake pads, tube or two, multi-tool, and then food. Everything else on there is food. Just, and for that one, because I try to push straight through on that one, there's, I don't know, it's like a 180-mile section where there's really no resupply. Maybe it's 150 miles. So you pretty much have to carry everything nutrition-wise from the start. There's a handful of resupply points, but they're just most everything's closed, obviously, in the middle of the night. So it's not really helpful. And in North Georgia, a lot of things are closed on Sundays. So just limited hours when you start a race on Saturday.
So, you know, most bikepacking races, you know, there's not a lot of prize money. There's no big sponsors. So you're just kind of racing for bragging rights, you know, but it's also insanely competitive and extremely painful. So why?
Yeah, why? Maybe I don't want to know why, because then I wouldn't do it anymore.
But, yeah, don't think about that one
too
much.
Yeah, no. It's, I don't know. It's, for me, a lot of it's just the kind of the sense of adventure and the thrill of being able to cover these big distances under my own power, but also, you know, some mental and emotional, you know, limit pushing. And it's just a game I've been playing for close to 20 years now of just, you know, how far can you push it today? Where's your limit? And see if you can step over that.
Yeah, it seems like that's kind of the draw. And that's why people are really into bike packing, because it's one aspect of mountain biking that's still like really pure, right? Like people just do it because they want to do it. And they have that need for adventure and pushing themselves. So, yeah.
It is. I mean, it just, you're out there and it's, I don't know, you against the world. You against the elements, you against whatever mountain you're trying to get over. And it's, yeah, I mean, you kind of learn a lot about the world and yourself in those situations, which is still interesting to me.
Yeah, I can definitely, you know, I did the Hurricane for the first time this year, and that's the longest I've ever ridden by far. you know, I've always kind of been more of an endurance guy myself, but more in the like 50-ish to, you know.
The fun endurance.
The fun endurance, exactly. You know, 6 to 12 hour races, you know, I've done a handful of 24-hour team races. But yeah, I think you kind of just have to go out and do it, right? Because I remember all my friends coming back from doing the hurricane and talking about how awesome it was. And I was like, what? Like, how can, you know, riding 300 and almost 50 miles through Central Florida be fun? But yeah, I went and did it this year, and it was incredible. Definitely a highlight of the year.
You see a whole different side of what Florida is when you get out there in the backcountry like that. It's really pretty, and the terrain changes a lot more than you would expect it to. So you go into it with all these, you know, kind of preconceived notions and come out the other side of it with a very different perspective.
So are you from Florida originally?
No, I grew up in Connecticut, but I ended up in Florida for 5 or 6 years before I moved to Georgia.
So back to racing. What are Eddie O'Day's keys to success? What are the seven habits of highly effective endurance ultra mountain bike racing?
I'd say number one is, for me, all about technique. So I don't do big volumes of training so much anymore, but I focus a lot on being able to ride without basically breaking down soft tissue. And you know, when you ride a cross country race, it's all out, and you want that peak power, and you don't think about how you might hurt yourself so much. Where in an ultra race, you just can't do that. So it's all about, you know, kind of preserving your body and good technique, you know, being very aware of how you're moving and how you're executing those movements, really has played into a lot of my success in those ultra races for sure. You know, just being as efficient with my power output is absolutely possible. Then nutrition's always crucial. It's usually a lot of people's breaking point. So over the years of honing that and knowing what works for me and executing that well.
Are you talking mainly nutrition during the race, or is some of that what you can do ahead of time?
Both of those things. I mean, I don't live like a monk. I still enjoy myself, but yeah, I mean, certainly having a good diet in general helps. And then, you know, there's kind of pre-race rituals. I'm a big believer in beetroot juice leading up to ultra races and or big training days. This stuff works really well. And then certainly, yeah, during the race. I mean, because if really crucial, if you're going to try to push through a night, that your nutrition is really spot on, because it doesn't take, you know, mess something up for an hour or two and all of a sudden you want to take a nap. And sometimes you have to. But, you know, to really execute those overnighters well, I mean, just having a really good nutrition plan and executing it makes it so much easier.
So some of these events you're doing where it's overnight, are you essentially carrying all your food with you?
Typically, yeah.
Okay. So yeah, because I got to imagine that, you know, when you're riding at that level, you got to have very specific things that you need at very specific times. And, you know, like you said, you know what works for you. Whereas, you know, when I did the hurricane, I was eating like Skittles and honey buns from the gas station.
Yeah. So yeah, for that style of racing, I use a lot of Infinite Nutrition drink mix. So most of my calories comes from, I'm drinking it out of a bottle as I go. And then as I have the opportunity to hit, you know, a gas station store or whatever, and then I like pizza and potato chips and a Coke. That usually works pretty well. But I try not to do really like gorge myself. I've done that before. And then you just have this, you know, gut bomb going on. It makes you want to take a nap. You feel awful. Even if you're not taking that nap, you feel awful for an hour or two until, you know, you get a chance to digest that. So you got kind of competing resources. If you eat that double cheeseburger, it's hard to go fast. So try to avoid those as much as I can. And just keep the energy level more steady. As I found in Tour Divide, that is not the same way that you can race something like that.
What about recovery? So how long, you know, let's say, you know, like the overnighters, like the Hurricane and Stagecoach and Transnorth Georgia, how long is your recovery time after an event like that? And then, you know, what are you doing? How do you spend that time recovering?
There's been a lot of variety in that. And I think the more training I do ahead of time, the less recovery time I have on the back end of it. And then if you go completely without sleep, the recovery line time is a lot longer if I, you know, get like a 2 or 3 hour nap. Just in 1 year period, I think it was 2013, I did the Stagecoach and won that one. That was the first one I did. It took a 20-minute nap, so pretty close to not sleeping for 40 hours. But my recovery was nearly 9 weeks.
Whoa. Wow.
Yeah, and that was a little scary. It starts to get in your head a bit because I had other races. I tried to do Dirty Kanza. I made it about 20 miles into it before I knew it was going to be a horrible day, and I wasn't recovered yet. And then later that summer, I had Fool's Gold. But also within a month, I did the Hurricane 300 straight through, and then a month later, I did Stagecoach. So that may have played into it as well. But then all of a sudden, 9 weeks later, I'm out on my ride, and I was like, God, I feel really good. Go home and look at the power files. It was like new peak power numbers, like just 9 weeks of nothing. And then all of a sudden, boom, it just all turned around, which was great because I had Transnorth Georgia coming up in about 6 or 7 weeks.
They packed them in.
I did a lot of long ones that year. And then, but after Transnorth Georgia, a week later, I did a short track race and won some money. So like the recovery was almost not really needed after that one, which is, you know, it's a very big contrast. So it's not always black and white, just how much recovery you're going to need.
Yeah, I can definitely attest to that after doing the Hurricane this year. Like I would, for, you know, probably 3 or 4 weeks afterwards, I'd go and ride and I just felt like I had nothing in my legs. And like sometimes, you know, I'd be posting, you know, pretty good times over segments that I ride regularly, but I didn't feel like I had anything in my legs. And then, you know, just one day it was like, it was all back and more.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you can even get fooled a little bit where you start, you know, pushing it a little bit. Like, oh, I feel really good. And then all of a sudden it's just like the bottom drops out and you feel absolutely horrid. So yeah, you got to be careful with that and listen to your body for sure.
So we know we'll talk in just a second about the Tour Divide, but you know how many races are you doing now? Typically, what's a typical calendar year for you as far as racing goes?
Oh, 3 or 4 races a year. Now a couple of those obviously are longer ones, but yeah, I just, you know, I've got a full time job running Endurance House Atlanta and doing bike fittings. And some coaching as well. So I keep myself pretty busy with, you know, real work versus spending all my time training like I used to and having time to go race all the time. So, yeah, so I don't get to do as many events. But, you know, pick the interesting ones for me now.
Is anything new or different you're going to do next year? Any new events?
I'm very interested in the Southern Highlands route that was recently published. So it's a combination of Virginia Mountain Trail, I think they're calling it. Western North Carolina Traverse, Transnorth Georgia, and the Skyway Epic. So two of those I've done, two of those I've never seen, but it sounds pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's something, was it 1,200 miles?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say too, we have Brett Davidson coming in to do a podcast awesome. In a couple weeks. So yeah, talking about that and the Eastern Divide route as well that he's working on. So.
Yeah, he's got a lot of really cool things going on with both of those. Yeah, I don't know about racing the whole Eastern Continental Divide. That's absolutely brutal. I don't know what total mileage on that's going to be. It's probably like 3,500 miles and 400,000 feet of climbing. And I don't think I'm totally exaggerating on either of those numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, the East Coast riding is just a lot different, right, than the West Coast where you have – you know, you have these long climbs that you can kind of settle into, whereas on the East Coast, it's just relentless up and down and up and down and up and down.
Yeah,
and down.
You know, 15 to 20% grades is normal.
Yeah.
That's the normal parts. Yeah, not railroad grades that you find in Colorado. And humidity. Humidity is a big deal on the East Coast, and that really changes things for ultra races.
All right, so let's talk about the Tour Divide, which you raced this year. It was your first time, right?
It was, yeah. Yeah, so nearly 2,800-mile route from Banff, Canada, down to the Mexican border at Antelope Wells, New Mexico. Again, ultra-raced, totally self-supported, and a really impressive mass start. I think we had about 185 people starting in wow. Banff this year.
Wow. That race has come a long way in not that long.
Yeah, for... you know, still a no entry fee race, somewhat underground. It's definitely blown up, but I guess that happens when you make a movie.
So How did you prepare for the Tour Divide, and how is that preparation different from the shorter ultras?
For the shorter ultras, I've trained a lot more than I did for the Tour Divide. I had a lot to do. Like I said, I'd been at Endurance House since we opened, and so obviously heavily involved in the day-to-day operation. So a big chunk of being able to do Tour Divide was being able to kind of exit out of that and make sure the store was going to function when I was gone. And that took up a lot of energy. And then we, with the Georgia Interscholastic League, you know, kind of put together this fundraising effort, which really blew up and was, that's really awesome, and appreciated all the support, but it also took a lot of energy as well. So that kind of left me to like putting equipment together and then occasionally riding. I think I had 2,000 miles in for the year before I started the race, which is for me very low, as I would like to be prepared for it. So I didn't have a lot of physical preparation. It was more, you know, trying to look over the route and kind of understand what I was getting into on that front and what equipment I would need for it. So I'd, even if I wasn't, or obviously wasn't in great physical shape, I had the right things with me, so I didn't get myself in trouble.
Yeah, so let's talk about your setup for the Tour Divide, because obviously, you know, this isn't an overnighter. So you're gonna have to bring a little bit more stuff with you, and you're no longer on a 26-inch carbon hardtail, right?
No, I'm on a 27.5 Siren titanium hardtail. And for Tour Divide, I put a MV rigid fork on it. There's very little single track, and it was just one less thing that would break down. You know, this suspension pork just really isn't totally necessary. If I did it again, I might look at something with a little bit of squish versus totally rigid like that. There's a lot of stutter bumps, but that was the bike. I had some wheel set made up by K-Lite USA, based here in Georgia, made up a dyno hub for my front, and a nice lightweight set of Knox wheels across the board. And outside of that, I didn't do anything crazy with aero bars. I had some ergon grips and a couple extra little bullhorn things in the center. So basically trying to still go with the, you know, kind of lightweight mentality, but still need more gear than I typically bring. So I had a small tent, a down quilt, sleeping pad, a pillow, air pillow.
So fancy.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a side sleeper, so I didn't think I'd make it through a couple of weeks without having a pillow. So you just gotta, because Tour Divide, you know, sleep is a big deal. You're not gonna get a lot of it if you're doing it right, but you want quality sleep. You know, you lose one night of sleep and that can mess you up for days out there. I had some new bags made up by the Spindle here in Atlanta as well, and made a couple custom bags for me. So a frame bag from them and a top tube bag. And then, the rest of it was a Revelate, saddle bag, another top tube bag, handlebar bag.
Cool. So how was nutrition on that route? Cause obviously, you know, you're not able to carry all your food with you. So was that a struggle for you? Like,
at times for sure. And it was definitely a big learning curve. So for the first couple of days, I was still kind of operating the way I would for any other ultra race, and I wasn't gorging myself too much, and that needed to change, because I was day one, I think I did 165 miles, then 125 miles, 175 miles, 100 miles, and then 40 miles. So you can kind of see where the trend went. So that day of 40 miles, I spent a lot of time eating, trying to kind of rebuild. And some of that was another story of losing my money, and then getting it back. It cost me a little bit of time, but I just mentally and physically, I was feeling really drained. I started off with a lot of my infinite powder and then sent it to myself at post offices throughout the route. I think like 10 of them, with the idea that I'd probably be able to pick up about half, which is, I think, how it worked out. But in between, then you've got, you know, whatever you can get at a store. So it's, you know, Gatorade and Coke and, you know, pizzas and Pop-Tarts, frozen burritos that you throw in a pack and they'll thaw out, you know, 8 hours later.
It's a good pro tip.
Yeah. It's not my favorite, but it works, you know, and like the little, pretty much anything that's frozen and pre-cooked, you can do that with. And then it took me till about halfway through to really learn like what I can order to go and take with me. And Subway's Subway sandwiches, they'll last forever. There's so much preservatives in those things. No problem carrying that around for 12, 18 hours and eating later. But just, you know, realizing that you're at a restaurant and ordering two meals immediately and then be like, hey, can I get like, can you wrap up some grilled cheeses to go or peanut butter and jellies to go or things that'll travel well without spoiling and messing up your stomach later. I also learned to carry a jar of peanut butter at all times and just add that to everything, whether I was, you know, out in the wild putting on Pop-Tarts and Snickers bars or at a restaurant and just always get a side of French toast and put peanut butter on it.
Nice. That sounds good right now.
I know.
So what was the highlight of the Tour Divide for you? Particularly memorable moments?
There were some really good days of riding. I mean, day one was just amazing, just to kind of finally be starting it all and just the views. And that the views part continued on throughout. I think there was really only one day that I could kind of just throw away on that whole ride. But yeah, I mean, just the amazing views of the Canadian Rockies. They're just quite stunning. But yeah, it's hard to pick just one highlight out of 21 days of things. But the views, every time I'd get, you know, it's this contrast of just being mentally and physically spent and over it all. And then you turn a corner and you're just like, oh my God, this view is amazing. This is so cool. I'm so glad I'm out here. You know, and then you struggle on through the next bit. You start getting low again and turn that corner again. And there's another one. So it's certainly, yeah, the views and the wildlife were pretty amazing.
Yeah. Any cool wildlife sightings?
I saw badgers in the wild, which I'd never seen before. A couple of golden eagles. Didn't see any grizzlies, which I'm not going to complain
too
much about.
Yeah, that's probably a good thing.
They were certainly around. Other racers were telling me of their sightings. I saw one black bear, which was cool, but not, you know, anything too thrilling. Several foxes. And riding through a herd of elk is pretty scary.
I bet. What about lowlights? Were there any points where you were like, F this, I'm done, like,
yeah,
get
absolutely.
Me out of here?
The moment where I realized I had lost my money. So pro tip, spread your cash and your credit cards out in your kit. Don't keep it all together, which I did. And at some point on Richmond Peak in Montana, it fell out of my bag. I don't know if I was getting my camera or bar or whatever. So there it laid on the ground. And about, I don't know, maybe 60 miles later, I get to Ovando and there's a lady from the fishing shop there, and she's, you know, all about getting everybody's picture and posting it up on her Facebook page as they come through. And it's really cool how this town gets into it. But I'm roll up and I'm thinking, all right, I need to get batteries at the general store and then go to the restaurant and eat and be on my way. And so I go to get my money and go in the general store, and I can't find it where I usually put it. So I'm like, all right, well, maybe I left it in my jacket because I put my credit cards and my chapstick in my pocket when I went to sleep at night. So I had my two most important things. Not there. And I just start pulling my whole kit apart. It's just a yard sale. Everything's coming out of my bags. And the third time I go through it all, and she's standing there trying to get my picture, and I'm just totally dejected and angry at the world. Yeah. So that was definitely a low moment for sure. Followed by a high the next morning of I got a text from Alex Hawkins, who found my money and said, hey, you know, I'm on my way to Ovando. I'll be there in an hour and a half. And so, yeah, all's well. Everything got fixed.
That's awesome.
One other was past Lima, and I had a really good day going. I'm about 120 miles in, plan on pushing for a really big night that night and try to do another like 40, 50 miles. And I was kind of following this storm, rode into it a little bit, and then it moved on. And the road just turned to peanut butter. In a 5 mile section, it probably took me an hour and a half, 2 hours, totally flat section. And mud built up so much on my tires that I couldn't even turn the rear wheel over. You couldn't see the bottom bracket anymore. It's just stuck. Meanwhile, there's riders going right by me, and I could not get my head around, like, why isn't this happening to you? Why do you hate me right now, Tour Divide? So I'd have to stop in creeks and, like, you know, hand wash my bike in a creek, which was freezing, and then start going again. Half mile later, you know, trying to find another creek to do it all over again. So needless to say, I didn't cover big miles that day. It was rather frustrating. I thought my bike would be wrecked at that point. My drivetrain would cease to function. There were some protests the next morning out of the drivetrain when I got going, but eventually found an RV park where they let me use a hose to clean it up, and it was all back to working again. Yeah. And then you start rolling into the Tetons and you're like, oh, pretty views. This is great. Everything's wonderful again.
So did you have a specific goal for it this year? Because, I mean, like you said, this is, it's the first time you've done it. It's, quite a bit different than some of the other races that you typically do. So did you have something set before you started?
Loosely. I mean, I was thinking like 17 days was a possibility. And I know that's very ambitious for that course. The fastest guys are around 14 days. And I really didn't think that was going to be a possibility for my first time out. But I ended up at 21. I think if I hadn't lost my money, 20 is certainly a possibility. But it was really humbling to do the weekend long overnight kind of things. And I've been very successful and can execute those really well. And this was just a totally different beast. Just the amount of fatigue that's built up a week into it, and to have that mental drive of just go, 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 go. I'll skip sleep. I'll, rush through this town constantly. It just wears on you for sure. It's hard to be in that, adrenaline filled state for that long.
For the better part of a month.
Yeah, exactly. So even towards the end, all the way through, I kept trying to figure out where I could try to make up some more time and put a little bit more effort in, ride a little bit later into the night and cover some more ground. But every day afterwards, I'd have, if I could execute that the next day, it'd be a total struggle. And not always just because of the physical, it's just, that route just keeps throwing things at you like headwinds. I remember pushing out of Abiquiu and over the mountain range there down into Cuba. And I slept on that ridge line through the night and then rode into Cuba, probably got there around noon, and it's pan flat road section for 120 miles to Grants. And in my head, I'm like, yeah, I can knock this out tonight. I'll get a hotel in Grants and a shower, and that'll be awesome. And it took me 3 hours to do the first 25 miles.
Oh, man.
Which was mostly, it was like a 1% downhill grade, but it was a 23-mile-an-hour headwind.
Whoa.
And I just had to stop at a gas station. I just took a nap in front of a gas station for like 40 minutes. And continue to plug on to this headwind. And just, I think I made it about halfway through that night before I had to sleep on the side of the road. And you just, you have to, you're constantly adjusting your expectations out there.
Yeah, headwinds are cruel.
Yeah.
For sure. Probably nothing more demoralizing.
Yeah, I mean, like climbing a mountain versus riding into a headwind is just totally different mentality. You feel like you're conquering something because there's an end to that mountain. You don't know when the headwind's going to end.
So are you one and done on the Tour Divide, or are we going to take it on again?
What do you think? I hope not. Now that I know what I'm doing, I'd love to go back and give it another try. But it's going to be at least a couple of years before I go back. I mean, the financial hit was certainly one that's going to take me a little while to get over. And it was basically the week before the race, didn't really work. Then I got 3 weeks of the race itself, which was, several days longer than I planned. And then the recovery period, it was about 3 weeks before I could really function back at work and get back to making some money. So it was a lot of time off, and I didn't, that's obviously not all paid vacation there. So that financial hit was a little bit tough, but I definitely want to go back. I mean, it's such a cool adventure, and meet really cool people, like-minded people who are out, trying to do the same things, and just the scenery. I'd go back for the scenery alone.
Yeah. I did a bikepacking, it was a semi-supported bikepacking ride, so nothing along these lines, but yeah, I did it from Fort Collins to Steamboat Springs, and yeah, just the views out there, incredible. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine having 3 weeks of that is got to be pretty awesome.
Yeah. Well, hopefully next time it's not 3 weeks, but yeah. If it is, I'll still enjoy it.
Cool. So as we said in the intro, as part of your Tour Divide race, you raise money for the Georgia NICA chapter, which is the National Interscholastic Cycling Association. And we actually talked to Kenny Griffin. Yeah. We talked to him on a podcast a couple weeks ago. So how did you get involved and how'd you come up with the idea and what does the Georgia League mean to you?
I got involved. I was initially part of kind of a almost brand ambassador kind of thing for NICA on the national level, just to help kind of spread the word about NICA and what they were doing. And then I had met Dan Brooks, who's now chairman of the board, previous Georgia League director. So I got talking with him one day, and he was at a point in his life where he was looking for something interesting, cycling related, positive impact on the world kind of thing. And I was like, hey, I'd heard about this, you know, outfit called Nika. Let's start up a league here in Georgia. And that happened. We were able to put that together, a successful application for Nika, and execute the first race season with Kenny and many other people's help. Had about 100 kids that first year. Now fast forward to 4 years later, there'll be about 750, 800 kids in the league this year. First race coming up on this Sunday, September 10th.
That's awesome. So you kind of mentioned your job a little bit. So in addition to the racing and the bike fitting and former race promoting, you're now at the Endurance House. So what is the Endurance House, and what do you do there?
Endurance House is a multi-sport store in Alpharetta, Georgia. If you're into triathlon, we got everything you need. But if you're into any one facet, individual part of that, that's cool too. Got everything from road to tri to hybrid and mountain bikes. It's running and walking shoes, nutrition, recovery products, swim stuff like wetsuits and goggles, swimsuits and that kind of stuff. And then all the services. It's a full-service bike shop, full-time mechanic. And then the bike fitting, wheel rentals, wetsuit rentals. And we just got a lot going on. There's coaching programs for multi-sport and cycling or running specific stuff. So just a lot of things happening with that store, which is fun.
Yeah, you mentioned you do coaching. Do you do that through the store, or do you do that kind of on the side? And
through the store.
Yeah.
So I write training plans, kind of group training plans to share with various groups for individual events. I also do one-on-one coaching as well.
Yeah, so while you were on the Tour Divide, you rode near, I guess, Salida, Colorado, which is where our editor Greg lives, and you had a chance to talk to him while on the road, right?
I did, yeah. Greg and I go back a little ways. He used to do social media for me at Fool's Gold. So, yeah, it was kind of cool to see a familiar face out on the trail. Rode along with him for, I don't know, about maybe an hour, I guess. He tried to record some of that, but it was one of those crazy headwind days, so I don't think too much of that came out, but he put together what he could out of that.
Yeah, I think he kind of thought maybe you were going to stop.
He was like, yeah, we didn't really work out how the logistics.
Or slow down. He said he was having a hard time just keeping up with you.
We didn't really work out the logistics of it, but no, I was not stopping or slowing down.
Yeah, it's an interview on the go. So if you want to read that, you can check that out on singletracks.com along with reports from events like the hurricane and other things, and the Steamboat Ramble that I did that I referred to earlier. But yeah, I want to thank Eddie O'Day for joining us here at the Single Track Studios. And if you like the podcast, go over to Google Play or iTunes, wherever you get your podcast from, and give us 5 stars. That's all we got for you this week. We'll talk to you next time. Later.